Hello and welcome to this new edition of the Middle East Today. I'm your host, Maryam Saleh. Washington has confirmed it is to send an ambassador to Damascus, ending a four-year diplomatic absence in Syria. On one hand, it is seen as a positive move by President Barack Obama to increase engagement with the region. On the other hand, some analysts who are critical of U.S. foreign policy remain skeptical and say that this could be a way to weaken Syria's alliance with Iran and movements which take on the responsibility of military resistance against Israeli occupation, namely Hezbollah and Hamas. Now, to get some in-depth analysis on this issue, I'd like to welcome with me today Mr. Nick Noh, editor-in-chief of MideastWire.com, and Mr. Nabil Saman, who is a Syrian researcher from Damascus. I want to welcome you both to our show. Let me begin with you, Mr. Noh. Has the U.S. realized that their absence in the region does more harm than good, and that their presence, even if there is mutual criticism between them and Syria, for instance, would be good for its interests?
Well, I think the Obama administration has made that fundamental shift, absolutely. Although you have to be careful when you talk about any administration. The Obama administration has many differences within itself, within its structure, within its personnel as well. So, for example, Ambassador Jeffrey Feltman is now sort of the point person, former ambassador from Lebanon, from the U.S. to Lebanon. He's now sort of the point person on relations with Syria. So, for example, he notified the Syrians that the ambassador would be coming. Jeffrey Feltman is seen by many people in Damascus, as well as in Lebanon, as a very polarizing figure, as having been one of the sort of lead proponents in the Bush administration for severing relations with Syria, for taking a very hard line with Hezbollah and the opposition here in Lebanon. That said, there are other actors that make up the Obama administration policy on Syria that have a different point of view, and apparently are the George Mitchell, the envoy for the greater sort of Arab-Israeli peace process. He's one that I would sort of consider as having fundamentally shifted from the Bush administration years, whereas what you said held true, I think, in his analysis and in the analysis of others in the Obama administration, some others, that the lack of engagement really didn't help their interests in the region.
All right, we'll talk more about that, about perhaps the practical steps that could be taken by the U.S. administration. But first, let me go to Mr. Nabil Saman. Mr. Saman, how does Syria look at this initiative by President Barack Obama?
Well, in my book, I think it is positive. It is positive step. Considered by the Syrian, from the American. This is the return of the American ambassador to Damascus is a sign of a change by Obama policy. You know, the Syrian-American relations are obscured and contradictory over the past few, I would say, three decades or so. You know, there is a love-hate relationship between Damascus and Washington. The reason for this, I think there is sometimes interest meet and sometimes divert. When they divert, there is a clash between the two parties. And when they meet, there is a state of coolness between the two parties. This is, I would say, over the past three decades, it was like a state of coolness, as I said, and a state of angriness from the American sides. However, things changed when the Bush administration took over, and after the invasion of Iraq, Syria took a negative stand as far as the American invasion of Iraq. And also, Syrian did not like what it sees as a change in American policy. In the past, the American deal with Syria as give and take policy, or I would say the American would demand and the Syrian would adjust to these demands. But at a later stage, when the Bush administration took over the administration, they start demanding things, not I would say ordering things rather than demanding, and instead of haggling or negotiating what they want, they start ordering Damascus, and this was not from Damascus.
Yes, now Mr. Saman,
this is the start of a tension point.
Yes. Now, it seemed that U.S. hatred was at its peak after the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. Why do you think this change has occurred now?
Well, there is a change in the American policy, no doubt about it. The Obama administration thinks that she needs many things from Syria. The Bush administration failed to get anything by pressure. Obama realized that he can get Syria to do a few things at least, three negotiations through soft talk through, give and take situation. Obama realized that Syria is an important player in the Middle East process. The United States wants Syria to play a role in Iraq. The American plan to withdraw from Iraq means that Syria can help a self-withdrawal of the American troops, not what happened in Vietnam where there was a chaotic withdrawal.
Yes, Mr. Shamal, thank you. I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you in 1 minute. Let me just get Mr. Noh's take on this. What do you think is the reason behind this shift? Do they really realize that Syria can play a pivotal role in the region and the peace process?
Well, I think that the Bush administration recognized that Syria could play a pivotal role and does play a pivotal role. They had a different approach than the Obama administration seems to have at this opening stages, because we're really at the beginning of the Obama administration putting its policies into practice, putting its words into action. I think that that's true. I think there's also another alternative, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is that, you know, not only is Syria sort of pivotal vis-a-vis some nearby relations, Iraq, Lebanon, the relations with, or the peace process with Israel, let's say, but also in light of these election problems in Iran, it's also seen by many people in the Obama administration, and also, I would also say, conservatives and some of the neocons in the U.S., that one can drive a wedge between Syria and Iran, and that now is a perfect time to do that. A lot of people in the U.S. have been arguing for some time, actually, including former Bush administration officials, that the interests between Syria and Iran do not align very comfortably, and that if one takes the correct approach, for the Bush administration it was through pressure, but for the Obama administration, we think, probably through a sort of a carrot policy of trying to wean them away from the Iranians, now is the perfect time.
So you think the timing isn't that innocent, but do you think it could be, is it workable at this stage?
I mean, that depends on how you view the relationship between Syria and Iran. I think that there is a certain amount of, let's say, overconfidence on the part of some Obama administration officials and some people in Washington on both sides of the aisle that Syria can fairly cheaply, let's say easily, be sort of split away from Iran. I think that that's going to be a very, very difficult proposition. And it means the Obama administration has to put on the table some real substantive offers. And I think that that's going to be very difficult. If Obama is having so much difficulties pressuring Netanyahu to just stop settlement growth, for example, it's just a as one part of many different issues on the table. Are they really going to be able to put enough pressure to get some of the things that Syria says is its minimum condition? The Golan, for example, where the line is. These are going to be very difficult things. So I think there's a bit of overconfidence about how easily one can split Iran and Syria, let's say.
All right. Mr. Salman, what do you think about this? Do you think that this timing is in order to try and find a shift or a wedge between Syria and Iran? And do you think that it could work?
Well, I think this is an old, new approach. It started from the Bush administration. I don't think it's workable. I think it is just a talk now. It is becoming an old story the American can drive a wedge between Syria and Iran. The American cannot deliver what they say. Even what they cannot pressure Netanyahu to do, as my friend said, to do the few things about the settlement. So, they are talking about a major shift in Syria, and I don't believe so. I think up to this moment, there is no American strategy towards Syria. In the past now, it is just reaction to the events in the area, and that's what's all American policy in the Middle East. There is no well-defined strategy towards Syria. And all what happens that some people, as our friend said, few people will believe, well, we can deal with Syria in this way, and we can deal in Syria in the other way. But that's workable. There is a well-established policy toward Iran, toward the Hezbollah. You know, it worked that to drive a wedge between Syria and Hezbollah. There is strategic element in the Syria policy, but there is no element in the American policy except a few, you know, certain things in Syria and certain interests, like, as I said, the safe withdrawal from American troops from Iraq, for instance, to the peace, to help in the peace process, as far as pressuring the Palestinian and some Palestinian factions.
All right, could it
Syria
actually be a way to
support
begin
the resistance movement?
Yeah, could it actually be also a way to get to Iran, to start diplomatic talks, either direct or in Iran, through Syria?
Well, you cannot also, I can say, how can I try to drive a wedge between the two countries while you are trying to cater Iran towards
this
American
policy? This is a contradictory
policy. I don't think this
analysis
will work, and I don't think the American will do it again.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I don't think the American will take approach.
All right, let me get your take on this, Mr. No. What do you think? Do you think that it's actually the opposite? Somehow we're saying that, no, it's actually a way to get to begin diplomatic ties or diplomatic talks with Iran.
No, I think it feels as though the dominant thinking in policymakers is that the Iranian track of engagement, let's play, or hopefully is something, in a way, it's linked to dealing with enter the Iranian door through a Syrian gate, for example. You know, it's not the same thing as, for example, the Turkish mediation between Israel and Syria. I think that the dominant thinking is that there is a really good opportunity in these coming months to drive a wedge between Iran and Syria, not to use Syria and better relations with Syria to then improve the negotiate with Iran. I think that most of the American policymakers think that an improved relation between the U.S. and Syria actually makes things more difficult on the Iranian track, because there is going to be genuine concern in Iran and also among some of the actors that are supported by both states, Hezbollah, Hamas, for example, that this American overture and this American rapprochement with Syria is a very dangerous thing to Iran's interests, to Hezbollah's interests, to Hamas's interests. So actually, I think, you know, doing these two things in tandem at the same time, it's smart, but it's also not one where you think that one will help the other. It indeed may make the other track, the Iranian track, may make the Iranians more nervous and more cautious about dealing with the Americans.
If the turmoil in Iran is not solved, do you think this makes it easier for the U.S.?
I think it makes it easier because the Americans think a deal with Syria is low-hanging fruit compared to Iran, rapprochement with Iran, and the sort of Palestinian-Israeli conflict as well. Syria is oftentimes both rapprochement between Syria and the U.S. and also a peace deal between Syria and Israel is customarily viewed as the easier thing to get done. So in that sense, and what I'm worried about is that the American policymakers will put a lot of their efforts into trying to make that Syrian-Israeli, U.S.-Syrian rapprochement and peace process work, and that they won't put a lot of the efforts that needs to be put into relations with Iran and into a new direction with Iran. That in many ways, some Americans will be very happy, for example, if there is no peace with Iran, no rapprochement with Iran, but there is peace between Syria and Israel. Because at the end of the day, although Iran may, they say, represent a threat to the U.S. and Israel, it will be very contained. It will no longer have its Arab ally in Syria. What does this mean for Hezbollah? What does this mean for Hamas? I'm worried that that sort of, you know, in a way that it is more doable with Syria could mean that there's a certain pulling back from expending real efforts, legitimate efforts, on the Iranian track and also on the Palestinian-Israeli track as well.
And,
right? Exactly. Tracks. Maybe we're pursuing another. It seems to me the danger is pursuing another thing like what we did with Egypt, for example, by trying to peel off a major Arab state to try and weaken that sort of that threats that are said to be surrounding Israel. If we do that, you know, you might get peace between Syria and Israel, but you're still going to have a fundamental problem that must be resolved peacefully, which is how does Iran and the U.S. coexist exist, and how do they get their interests to merge, perhaps peacefully, in these coming
yes.
decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, would this be part of the all-in-all accord between Arab states, namely Saudi Arabia and Syria, which
exactly.
has been reflected in the Lebanese parliamentary elections?
Exactly. But the danger is, first of all, a deal with Syria, as he mentioned, mm-hmm. is going to be very difficult to get done. But let's just assume that the American thinking is correct, that we're on the right path, and that it's something that's doable. It's certainly more easy than doing it with these other states. If that gets done, and there's rapprochement between the Arab states and Syria, for example, well, what have we done? We've created a containment box around Iran. But the fundamental problems of the relationship between the Arab states and Iran, the U.S. and Iran, still exist. Questions over the nuclear program still exist.
So this might take up, yes, a lot of time.
Exactly.
Mr. Salman, I want to get what you think about how this might have been the result of the parliamentary elections in Lebanon. Does the U.S. feel that Syria did not influence the results or did not back its allies like it should?
Well, first of all, I would like to comment at what my friend said. The Syrians are aware that the Americans are trying to create a wedge between Iran and Syria, so it became well known. The Syrians have a strategic policy, but it, as I said, but to the American, it is just a reaction to the event, as I said. So it is the fundamental policy of Syria is to have a strong relationship with Iran, which has been over the past two, three decades in a way. And it has good relation with Hezbollah, and it believes in the resistance movements and Hamas in Damascus. And I don't believe Damascus is... while it is serious about starting indirect negotiation with Israel, but I don't believe the Syrians believe that it will end up in a peace, because you know we learned from the past that it is just a talk. You know, the Israelis are not serious about withdrawal from the Golan Heights. They need the water of the Golan Heights. They want to meet. They want to make the Golan Heights. Non-belligerent area or whatever. So this is not acceptable to Syria. So we are talking about imaginary thing about peace, while where the American think that through carrot, you know, the Syrian will be motivated to have peace at whatever cost. I don't think the Syrian people will accept this. That the American talk as if there is no Syrian people. The Syrian will not accept any peace deal with Israel. This is very important. As far as the election in Lebanon, I think Syria, it is in the interest of Syria that there be a peaceful Lebanon. It is in the interest of Syria that there will be no chaotic situation, because it affects the Syrian regime. And so, the new election is in a way a blessing to Syria, and in a way a blessing to Hezbollah, because he has no there will be no pressure on Syria to pressure Hezbollah if he had won the election. If Hezbollah had won the election, then there will be pressure on Syria to pressure Hezbollah to do certain things, and all kind of problems. So I think it is contrary to the common thinking in Washington. What's going now is a blessing to Syria.
Yes, I have one more question for you. The peace process, many observers are saying it's not going anywhere right now. Do you think that this is a way to buy time? That the only thing that President Obama, U.S. President Obama, has in his hand right now is to try to get closer to Syria, even if he does not get anything from Syria or Israel?
Well, as I told you, he needs Syria for Iraq. Iraq is very important. We are talking about withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. There were talk that the American may withdraw through Syria. I don't know if it is true or not, but there were talk about the withdrawal of troops. The safe withdrawal of troops is very important to the American. The American are aware that the American can influence many parties in Iraq. And you see, look what's happening in Iraq today. There were bombing, killing, and this is just before the withdrawal of the American troops from the cities. So imagine what will happen if the American troops withdraw. You know, so Syria can play a very big role in Iraq. And I think while they are talking about the peace process, while the American wants mm-hmm. to help Israel in a way, and you know, buy time to avoid at least war or
yes.
fight clashes between Syria and Israel. If there is no peace process, then you are talking about tension in the border, you know, talk about whatever, you know, like resistance movement in Lebanon, in Syria, whatever it is.
Yes,
so this is a one way of cooling the area.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Salman. Now, do you think, Mr. Ngo, that we might see practical steps, or would the U.S. actually ask for more conditions from the Syrians?
Well, we're just at the beginning of the stages of asking for conditions and putting requirements on the table. You know, the U.S. has just sent its ambassador back to Syria after a gap of many, many years. And it's just sent George Mitchell there after a gap of many years, as well as other Obama administration officials relatively recently. So we're at the beginning of the process. It's going to be a long process. There are certainly going to be a lot of the same old demands of the Bush administration, demands that the Syrians are very familiar with. The question is how those demands or those needs, as they'll probably now be called.
These needs, you mean on the peace process?
Needs for the relations Americans, with Israel. Needs for the Israelis, needs for the Syrians, needs for neighbors. In other words, the negotiation process that, you know, is slowly starting has a whole list of needs for all of the different parties that are very well known to all of the different actors. There is a different approach to how you exactly bargain over and how you order those needs, for sure. And we've seen a sort of an end to the approach of you give us everything that we want or almost everything that we want, and then we'll be willing to talk to you and give you some of what you said you want. It seems as if we're done with that approach. But that doesn't mean that resolving these fundamental issues is particularly easy. Of course, it's not easy, as the other guests mentioned. It's going to be very difficult for the Obama administration to put pressure on the Israelis on multiple fronts. So if we've seen how difficult it is for Obama to put pressure on settlements, and now he's engaging the Israelis, how is he going to do that? How is he going to do that vis-a-vis Iraq and the border there?
Well, if it's hard to let Israel cooperate, do you think that Syrians will be more cooperative?
I think that the Syrians are in the catbird seat right now. They're in a position of relative power, especially to where they've been over the past few years. I think that they're in a good position to be able to finally perhaps give some cards or to give some demands to the United States. You know, if the Americans come in and say, shut down Hamas's office and kick them out of the country, and then we can talk about the Golan, obviously that's a non-starter. Mm-hmm. But relations with Lebanon, for example, the election of the new premier, will Hezbollah's arms be in the new cabinet? These are areas where the Syrians can be very helpful, and on Iraq as well.
This is something they might discuss. All right, I want to thank you both very much, Mr. Nabil Salman from Syria, Nicholas Ngo from here. Thank you so much. All right, and we'll be right back. Stay with News in Brief. Stay with us.
Today on Press TV, a UN team has initiated public hearings with victims of Israel's 22-day war on Gaza. The UN Human Rights Commission also plans to hold hearings in Israel and the West Bank. But Israel has refused to cooperate with the inquiry, accusing it of being biased. Iran says at least 8 local employees of the British Embassy in Tehran have been arrested. They're accused of being involved in post-election riots in Tehran. Earlier, the Iranian government had summoned the British ambassador of what it called London's interference in Iran's internal affairs. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak has arrived in Japan for talks with Prime Minister Taro Aso. North Korea's nuclear program and reportedly planned missile tests are expected to top the agenda. Lee and Aso are also expected to discuss ways to encourage China to put more pressure on Pyongyang. Britain has marked its first ever Armed Forces Day by holding parades across the country. Armed Forces Day was instituted in response to criticism that not enough has been done to recognise the bravery and sacrifices of British service personnel. Nearly 170 British troops have died in Afghanistan since the beginning of the US-led occupation in 2001. And a replica of an ancient Philippine boat has hit the water in Manila. Adventurers who have conquered Mount Everest led the recreation of the wooden boat used 17 centuries ago. They hope the vessel will take them on to Africa. That's the latest here on Press TV.
Welcome back to the Middle East Today from Beirut. Jumping on to another topic, to meet in Cairo this Monday in an effort to make amends, especially on the issue of political arrest, which the two been accused. Of course, the focus of continues to be on the resistance against Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory and the building of settlements. Now, Fatah Labbas, on the other, encourages talks with the Israelis who have not stopped building illegal settlements. With my guests today, we have Hussein Ibish, Executive Director of the Foundation for Arab American Leadership from Washington. We also have Palestinian researcher Khaled Abu Hed, who is right here in Beirut. I want to welcome you both to our show. Let me begin with you, Mr. Khaled Abu Hed. First, do you think Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are on the verge of reconciliation?
On this time, maybe they can arrive such a consensus because there are many issues that have been arised last week. First, the speech of Netanyahu and the last statement for the foreign minister, Lieberman. And I think the speech in Cairo for the President Obama, which make some pavement for the road on make some speech and forget the speech of Khaled Mishal in Damascus yesterday. I think the whole situation, except for the Israeli part in this position, we have some thing that may indicate to have reached a consensus. But can this lead to a total agreement for all the issues? I don't think so. Not in this in this time.
All right. Let me jump to Mr. Hussein Ibish. Do you think that that Hamas and Fatah are on the verge of reconciliation? And do you think that Egypt can play an important role in this?
Well, I think Egypt does play a very important role. And I think that Egypt and Saudi Arabia are pushing very hard, and they have been pushing very hard, for a Palestinian unity government. However, I don't really think that Hamas and not just Fatah, but the PA in general and the PLO even, are not on the brink of a reconciliation. I think the divisions between them, especially on questions of how to deal with Israel, are simply too great. And although it is conceivable that there could be a unity government that is basically technical people who are liked by both sides, but who don't represent particularly Hamas, might form a government, I'm skeptical of that. And certainly, as long as Hamas continues to reject the conditions of the quartet and reject the idea of negotiations with Israel, it's going to be impossible to have a unity government, especially one that pursues an agreement.
Yes. How about the issue of political prisoners on both sides? Now, this seems to have been triggered after Hamas won the parliament, the majority of parliament, and Fatah was not very accepting of this. Do you think that this is what triggered the whole problem between the two sides?
No, I don't. I think that what happened is the split between the West Bank and Gaza in 2007, not the election in 2006. And it's definitely true that both parties in the areas that they control, Hamas in Gaza and the PA in the West Bank, have arrested each other's members, and there are a lot of prisoners on both sides. And it's conceivable that there could be an agreement with regard to prisoners. But I don't think, and I don't these issues worry that would be both a presidential election and a parliamentary election, because we've had two elections in Palestine, a presidential election in 2005 and a parliamentary election in 2006, and each party won one of those. So obviously, you need to have a new election to make the will of the Palestinian people clear And I certainly hope and expect that'll happen as the parties agreed to in January 2010.
All right. Now, Mr. Khaled, do you think that that Egypt can play an important role in this reconciliation, which Serbish is saying that is not very likely?
Egypt as a power, yes, can play a big role in the Palestine and in many different issues. Egypt had many cards to play if the administration in Cairo wants to play that. But the problem here is that issue. Cairo has presented itself and put in a position that it only wants to implement over Hamas and over Mahmoud Abbas what the quadruple and the administration and White House want, not what it should be for the Palestinian issue. Here, Cairo, if it can plays a role for the releasing of the prisoners from both sides, yes, this may be play a role for the. But it has a condition. Now we hear from the media that the condition is the release of Gilad Shalit. If you the report media, they said that Gilad Shalit may be released or can be delivered to Cairo in the few coming hours. This is first. Second.
Now this should be the price for inter-Palestinian reconciliation. Is that what you're saying?
I am afraid that Cairo put this condition, and on the other hand, I am afraid that the releasing of the head of the parliament, of the Palestinian parliament, the release in the West Bank from the Israelis is in making the conflict between Hamas and Fatah more exaggerated conflict. The Israeli wants for the conflict between Hamas and Fatah in Gaza and PLO, in the West Bank, to put again and again, because as we know, and as your guest, Mr. Ibish, said, now Hamas controlled over Gaza Strip, and PLO and Fatah controls the West Bank. Now Hamas has no power in the West Bank. Releasing the head of the parliament in West Bank make for Hamas to rebuild some of its strength, and this will lead, I'm afraid mm-hmm. that Israel plays this card. This will lead to another conflict between Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank, and so the issue of the prisoners between Hamas and Fatah may not be received because of this Israeli.
All right. Well, Mr. Ibish, another issue: the role of the U.S. Perhaps in this reconciliation and in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now we heard from Khaled Mishal just yesterday saying that the words of President Barack Obama seem to are more positive towards Hamas. They seem to have gotten a message also from former President Jimmy Carter. Do you think that this can be a positive step towards reconciling the Palestinians and solving some of the issues between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Yeah, before I come to that, let me just make a couple of other points. I think that Egypt plays its own role. I don't think they just reflect the American point of view. And I think that the push that the Egyptians have been making for Palestinian reconciliation reflects Cairo's interests and not Washington's interests. So I think there's a difference there. Mm-hmm. Now, as for the relationship of the United States and Hamas, I think that, obviously President Obama opened the door for Hamas to potentially play a role, but he reiterated the quartet conditions. And I think that as long as Hamas refuses to make a gesture to accommodate the quartet conditions, especially agree with the goal of a two-state solution and honor the existing Palestinian commitments, that it's going to be very hard for Hamas to become part of the international dialogue. And so insofar as President Obama's initiative to engage the Middle East, which I think is excellent, encourages Hamas to continue amending its policies and to think about the wisdom of agreeing to these things, which are very much in the Palestinian national interest, that they can play a constructive role, that's a very good thing. But if they continue not to do that, then mm-hmm. I don't think they'll be dealing with the United States.
Haven't they accepted the issue of two-state solution on the condition that the borders are back to the 1967 borders before Israel invaded parts of Jerusalem and the West Bank? They have agreed to this, and of course they had other conditions on the issue of the settlements.
Yes. I don't think that's right at all. I think what they've done is they've made a lot of contradictory statements. And they've been cultivating what is called politically constructive ambiguity, so that some people say something one day and somebody else says something the other day. But the official policy of Hamas continues to be looking for a hudna and not a peace agreement, and not looking for two states. And this is a big difference. And so obviously you can point to a lot of statements by Mishal and others that suggest that they might be interested in that. But you can point to a lot of statements by a lot of other people, including by Mishal and others, which contradict that. So what is necessary for Hamas to do is not to make different statements on different days by different people, but to have a clear statement that everyone, including their supporters, will understand that they have agreed that the goal is a two-state solution. If they actually did that, then they would start to play a very different role, and national reconciliation with the PLO could become a real possibility.
All right. Don't you think that the fact that also Israel has not given in to the G8 proposal and the U.S. Demands to stop building settlements, doesn't that in some way play a role to let Hamas stay insisting on its conditions?
Of course it does. Yeah, of course it does. The recalcitrance of Netanyahu, the refusal of Israel to live up to its obligations under the roadmap and its commitments and the very reasonable demands of the United States certainly can be a rationalization for any Palestinians to say, well, we don't have to do what we need to do because they're not doing what they need to do. And you get into this vicious circle. So definitely that's the case. However, I do think that as long as Hamas essentially puts itself in a position of not being able to be part of the international dialogue and preventing a serious move to national reconciliation because they can't play that role, then that also plays into the hands of Netanyahu. So you could argue, really, that Netanyahu and Hamas are kind of playing into each other's hands, and that the right wing among both Israel and Palestinians are kind of supporting each other in a way.
All right. Now, Mr. Khaled, what is your response on what you just heard right now about the issue?
Sorry, but Mr. Ibish had made as Hamas was the problem. Here, I would remember him that negotiation between the PLO authority and Israeli and the Israeli cabinet have been established since 1993 when they reached the Oslo Accord. Up to 2009, now, more than 15 years of negotiation, where have we come as a Palestinian people? Why do we blame Hamas over for its position, for its resistance, for its political issues? As we hear from the Israeli government, the new Israeli government, whether it is right wing or left wing, don't forget that in the past we have Barak in the cabinet, and we have other leftists from the Israeli part, and the Palestinians haven't get their rights. Now, Hamas is not the problem. It is a party. It is a resistance. And it has the legitimacy of representing the Palestinian people. That's what the last election have revealed. And now, when we come to another, to the next elections, I would ask the same question. What if Hamas won the elections again? Or what if the resistance won the election again? For this, here we have to come to a conclusion that from the Israeli part, we don't have anyone who wants to give any rights, even the rights that have been recognized by the council, the UN Council. For this, what they expect the Palestinian people to do?
Why has Hamas insisted on a truce rather than a long-term solution?
Because the recognition of two-state solution means that there is a recognition of the Israeli state, over a Palestinian land. Here we are talking about a land that has been occupied since 1948, and a Palestinian people has been swept out. Now, what about the right of the return for the Palestinian people? Recognition of the Israeli state, this means that the Palestinian people have recognized the recognition of a Jewish state, and this is a big problem, that the historical Palestinian land is not Palestinian anymore, that there is no right for the Palestinian people to return back according according to 194 resolution of UN resolution. And so this is a big issue. This is not a political issue. This is an issue that is related to history, that is related to the rights of the Palestinian people. It is not just Hamas wants so or not. Even I will tell Mr. Ibish and everyone else, even if any PLO authority recognized an Israeli state without the right of return, at least this is the bottom.
This is something that all Palestinians agree on. This is what you're saying.
Yes, will not. Here, remember what happened to Mr. Arafat. He went into the negotiations, but when he came to the issue of Al-Quds and the issue of the return, the right of the return, he has refused to make any other step.
Yes, because he knows that... Yes, this is very important for the Palestinians. Mr. Ibish, what is your response to what you just said?
I think that there isn't any other way for Palestinians to achieve their national interests and secure their rights without achieving a negotiated agreement with Israel.
I have another solution.
Armed struggle is
I'll
not going to produce the results. All right?
Yes.
So that means, hold on, I didn't interrupt you. That means an agreement with Israel. Okay, that predicates recognition of the Israeli state. You can't have an agreement with Israel without recognizing Israel and negotiating with Israel. So I think as long as you have Palestinian political parties that reject this, then they are just going to be an impediment to achieving the Palestinian national interest. And I think that there's a lot that can be achieved for the refugees in an agreement with Israel. And I think that there's a huge interest in achieving this agreement, and there isn't any other way.
No, there is another way. Let me tell you something. You in America says that. Okay, you in America says that you love democracy, and Mr. Bush has invaded Iraq for the democracy. Let's speak about one state with a democracy for two peoples. Let's discuss this matter. Why we don't live the Jewish and
totally
the Palestinian together on the same land, and let's have a government that is an elected government.
You won't get the Israelis to agree to that.
Sorry?
They won't agree to that. I can guarantee you that the Israelis will not agree to that.
But when the White House says it only agrees over a Jewish state, this is a bullet for the democracy. This is a bullet for any political issue. Here you are talking about 8 million Palestinians out of their land.
Yes.
I don't think you can sit there on principle and say, look, this is democracy and we demand this and we want it and that's it. I think you have to look at the realistic situation. Israel exists. It's a very powerful country. It's not going to capitulate. It's not going to collapse. It's not going to disappear. Armed struggle is not going to drive them out of the occupied territories. The only thing that can achieve Palestinian independence and secure Palestinian rights is an agreement with Israel.
Okay.
This is a reality.
You're not going to get them to agree to
a single democratic state in which Israel dissolves itself. That's a fact.
When you speak about facts and realities in this way, this means that you leave only one way to change this reality. That is power. That is resistance. That is struggle. That is fighting.
Why don't you recognize
the fact, the other fact that says that a Palestinian people, 8 million persons have been swept out of their land, of their right to come back
that,
to their land. And this is a UN resolution, number 194. Let's discuss this way. When you speak about this is a fact and this is reality and I have to deal with it, then you have put me in only one situation to resist and make another reality.
Yes, Mr. Ibish, I need you to tell me what you think is a good solution for the refugees. Yes, please tell me, Mr. Ibish. What do you think is a good solution for the refugees, since all Palestinians agree that the right of return is a must?
Well, no, I don't think all Palestinians agree that a mass return is absolutely essential for an agreement. I think that the right of return has to be upheld in principle, and I think that Israel has to acknowledge that, and a compensation has to be given, and I think there needs to be a return to a Palestinian state, and there should be a measure of return for Palestinians into Israel that is consistent with an agreement with Israel. But I think expect that the state of Israel is going to allow for a mass return of many millions of refugees into Israel is not something they're going to agree to. An agreement has to respond to the national interests of both peoples, and it has to be something that's achievable. Armed struggle is not going to cause the capitulation of Israel. This is something the Arabs have been trying to achieve for 60 years, and it is not going to work. I'm sorry.
Let me tell you something.
Yes, please. Let me hear your take.
Okay, right. you are speaking about facts, and let me tell you another fact, and you can get the numbers and make the study. Now in Gaza Strip, it is considered as the most condensed population on the land. Million Palestinian people from 1994 returns back to their homeland, and between, I'll tell you that 400 villages have been destroyed in 1948, and up to till now they haven't been reconstructed or rebuilt again. Okay, out of the bracket. If the 8 million people have been come back to their homes, and with the existence of the Jewish people in Palestine, the most population we will get there is 128 person per kilometer squared. This is still the least or among the least on earth. This is not the truth that if a mass come back, this is first. Second, this is if you are speaking about numbers, but here, if you are speaking about rights, it's not my problem if the Jewish have come from Europe and settled over my land.
Mr. Khaled, would the Palestinians accept a two-state solution?
Hold on.
Yes, Mr. Ibish, I'll get back to you. Just 1 minute.
It is told that Mr. Arafat told somebody in the White House that I cannot sign any agreement without the right of return because my guards will kill me because they are refugees.
All right, but let's say now Israel is a de facto government. It exists. There's no way that we cannot, you cannot recognize that this is what is okay, recognized by, let's say,
logic,
the United States.
But with this logic,
what would be your response then if the Palestinian state is to be established, on what conditions?
This keeps us only in front of one solution. If you are speaking about Israel that has been existed and it is a fact, so we have to deal with this fact to change it. Israel has been built with power, with guns, with bombing and destroying the villages, and now we have only one way to deal with it.
How about for a short-term solution? Would the Palestinians return to the 1967?
The 1967 solution is not a live solution. This solution cannot live anymore. This is not accepted, not from the Palestinian point of view, and of course not from the point of facts. You are now speaking about 1,500,000 living in Gaza.
Yes. Let me get just this from Mr. Ibish. I'll get your response, and just please tell me, would the U.S. be more assertive towards the Israelis to stop building settlements?
Yes. I think, first of all, let me deal with the second part. They have to be, and they are being, and they're going to be. I think that they are not going to accept any kind of cute deal which allows Netanyahu to continue taking Palestinian land. They may give him some face-caving measure, calling it temporary or allowing some minor things to go on, but major settlement activity is not going to be allowed, and I think that's pretty clear. I think the administration is being very tough on it, and you can see that from the cancellation by George Mitchell of his meeting with Netanyahu in response to Israel's announcement. So, as far as the reality is concerned, position that's adopted by my friend in Beirut, that we would just have war and occupation and conflict into the indefinite future. Nothing would be done to address the refugees' rights. Nothing would be done to make their life better. They would have no state to defend them. They would have no place to go. They would have no advocate. All of these things would happen if a Palestinian state were established. And I think to sit there and say, we don't want a Palestinian state, we want to remove Israel, we want to get rid of Israel, simply means another 60 years and the 60 years after that of fruitless conflict. We've had conflict for 60 years, and we know where we get.
All right, thank you.
I thank you.
The only way out is to have an agreement.
All right.
Thanks for your cute feelings, but let me tell you something.
If you hear, because we need to get through this.
If you hear Lieberman, only one sentence. If you hear Lieberman, you are talking about how to protect ourselves as refugees, and you suggest that a state will protect us. If you hear Lieberman, just last night he says that any state, and also Netanyahu, would be without weapons, without the right to make any army, without the right to make any kind of protection.
See, so what state are you talking about? On the issue about? Of political okay, prisoners
all,
between, between the Palestinian
Lieberman
Authority
is not
and Hamas.
God.
Just a quick answer on this, because our time is up.
I wish that this will be done, and I hope that will be done. But unfortunately, I don't think this will be done in the simplest way. It may take many negotiation timetables and not just one.
All right. Now, unfortunately, our time has run out for today. We had a great show today. Thank you so much, Mr. Khaled Abu Hayat from Beirut, for being with us. Mr. Hussein Ibish from Washington, thank you so much also. I want to thank our viewers for joining us. Let me remind you of our email, mideast@pressdvbeirut.com. We are waiting for your feedback. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye.